A general note for clarification, in the following interviews, you may hear those interviewed refer to learning mindsets as academic mindsets. The field around learning mindsets and skills is constantly shifting, and so too is our vocabulary. Recently, the Raikes Foundation conducted extensive research regarding the field and arrived at the title Learning Mindsets and Skills, Empowering Students to Unlock Their Potential. Rest assured that whether those interviewed are referring to academic mindsets or learning mindsets and skills, they are talking about the same thing. Welcome to the Learning Mindsets and Skills Massive Open Online Course Podcast Series. This series is brought to you by the High Tech High Graduate School of Education with support from the Raikes Foundation on the Coursera On Demand MOOC platform. Details about this massive open online course, as well as other courses offered by High Tech High, can be found at www.hightechhigh.org/MOOCs. That's www.hightechhigh.org/MOOCs. In our first installment of Week 3, we'll be focusing on creating effective dialogue, and we'll be hearing from two different speakers. Our first speaker is someone with over 30 years' experience in the education field.
I'm Elliot Washer, co-founder, co-director of Big Picture Learning.
As Elliot explains, Big Picture Learning has a unique mission in mind.
Working with communities and schools around the things that are on student interest, developing student interests in schools. And Big Picture Learning is a not-for-profit. It was started 20 years ago. That had a mission around working with low-income communities, that we have about 150 schools around the world now, and programmatically we're probably more different than anybody because of our focus around starting with the interests of each and every student and building curriculum around that.
During the 2015 Deeper Learning Conference, Elliot was part of a live discussion with our second speaker, whom you'll hear from shortly. But first, let's listen to Elliot discuss the importance of engaging with students both inside and outside the school.
The Finnish system is interesting because people talk about it differently than people, once again, I know talk about it. If you listen to educators here, most of them will talk about teacher training is great. That's true. It's very, very good. The curriculum is kind of tiny. Well, that's true. They do spend time with students in and outside of school. So that's all true. And what they don't talk about that I'll talk to you a minute about, I'll spend 2 minutes on this, is a guy named Otto Salomon and Cygnaeus, in the mid-1800s, started a methodology of school called Sloyd Education, which is still practiced in some private schools in the United States. And it's practiced in Finland, and people don't talk about it, and mostly all the Scandinavian countries. In Finland, if you go to any school from the time you're in kindergarten to the 12th grade, you have mandatory courses in textiles, ceramics, wood, glass, and fine arts. And students from, and Sloyd is a Sloyd is a knife in Swedish, Norwegian, and Finnish. And a Sloyd knife was given to a five-year-old and still is. I know that sounds, they're sharp knives too. And they don't cut their fingers off normally.
Normally.
And because carving is part of their culture. Nokia was a timber company before it was a phone company, or Nokia, I might not be saying it right, pardon me. And so that piece of they make stuff in school that goes into the home. They go from the concrete to the abstract, not from the abstract to I don't know what this is about to the concrete. And that's part of their system. Why we don't talk about it, I don't know. And the 1892 exposition in Chicago, Sloyd was introduced to the United States, and the Prussian system was introduced as industrial education. The Prussian system won out. Sloyd went out. There were actually 50,000 teachers trained in Sloyd in the United States in the early part of the 20th century. And it had a life. As a matter of fact, there's a woman in Santa Barbara who developed a system called Paper Sloyd, where she made all the objects out of paper that were made in school and brought to the home. I have the book at home. If anybody wants to see it, you can get it on the internet. So that piece of connecting hand and mind and heart, because it's home and it's relationships, making stuff in school that is practical and useful in the home, brings the school metaphorically and literally from the school to the home, where parents can use stuff and students know they made it. That's something that is very, very powerful, important. And the metaphor is when you take students and get them outside of school and get them doing stuff around their interests and bring that back into school, they're engaged. And it's a strategy, and it's something that we've done for a very, very long time and knew about. So that piece is really important. Not only is important, and I'll do one more. So when we go to Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, a lot of times we work with First People, Maori. We work with a 23,000 district school district in New Zealand. And Maori, if they were sitting in this room, most of them would have something in their hand and work and be doing some kind of craft work. It's just who they are. And they'd also be doing a lot of music. They would music is a big, big deal. And they'd also be standing up and sitting down, which we don't tend to do. They look at the work because we involve family and because we involve their world of trades and crafts that are both 21st century and traditional into their schools. They embrace the kind of schools that we had. So it was a big deal for them because a lot of times schools don't do that. And we have schools in the United States that have bought reservations that had some horrendous data around dropout rates that we've actually turned around. Of course, we paid attention to the culture, who the students are, who their families are, allowing families, of course, to come to presentations of students learning, exhibitions, and allowing the material that comes from the home into the school and back out. So it sounds simplistic, and it is, but it's very deep once again. These things are who we are and connected around relationships and objects. And schools miss out on that. So when we go to Australia and New Zealand, we have not-for-profits there, those not-for-profits are greeted because that's part of who we are as a school. And schools are usually trying to say, your community has no assets. We have to remake you into a college-educated person. You have to leave your community. And there's all these other problems. We don't want our young people to leave because they may not come back, and then we lose who we are, we lose our culture. And we lose our language, and this is very, very frightening to a lot of people. So how do you do both becomes the challenge. And that is a challenge that you deal with for each and every family and student.
Elliot also discussed equity when it comes to effective dialogue. But what exactly does that mean?
The equity to us is everybody gets the same. Same number of two pencils, same number of kids in a class, same kind of teacher, because you could trade one teacher for another teacher and not skip a beat because they don't have to know the kids, young people. They just have to know the content. And that's crazy. That's crazy. When we should have a system of equity on everybody gets what they want. There's real choices. Young people can make real choices. We don't believe that and we don't trust that. And one of the things when people talk about our schools, I say to them, what's the difference between our schools and other schools in deeper learning? What's the difference? He says, well, you trust children. That when they tell you what they like and what their interests are, you're going to act on it And that's the difference. I mean, it's kind of, these things are not rocket science and filled with rubrics and all that stuff. You know, when I assess young people in schools, our students, I go, how do you think you did? And if it's real to them, they'll tell you, I got to read these three books, talk to these people, and practice and practice and practice on these things. And if it's not real, it's inauthentic. They'll make stuff up.
Our next speaker also has a little something to say about equity.
My name is Carlos Moreno. I'm the National Director of Schools for Big Picture Learning.
And what exactly does that job role entail?
In that role, I'm responsible for our network of 52 schools around the country, and supporting those schools directly, indirectly, and liaising between schools and school districts and states.
In the live discussion with Elliot, Carlos provides his background as both an example and proof of why equity matters.
I'll actually take it back to how I ended up at Big Picture Learning, because I think that's really important. So I grew up, born and raised in the Bronx. As an undergrad, attended Johnson & Wales University, I went to public school, DeWitt Clinton, actually the school that Chris's younger brother went to that he mentioned this morning, a huge school that's been on the verge of being shut down, and this year's on the verge of being shut down again. Primarily there for, I played a variety of sports, so that's kind of what kept me eligible in a lot of ways, right? I needed to maintain a certain GPA so I can play baseball, football, basketball. I even played volleyball one year.
All right.
Short shorts. Yeah, it's good.
I like it.
At some point in my junior year, right, so like I had all types of issues and challenges in school, right? So I think I had maybe one core teacher that wasn't like gym or art teacher that looked like me at a school of about 5,000 students, which is ridiculous, right? Like it's really ridiculous. In my junior year, whether it was growth, I can never pinpoint what it was, whether it was maturity. I try to think if it was an adult connection. I had very supportive parents who were both immigrants who were just kind of like, you will do good in school. I can't necessarily, and they did whatever they could for me, but they were just like, you'll do good in school. We'll make sure you have a meal, you have a home, but the goal is that you're going to graduate high school. Decided at one point I wanted to go to college. Hurt my knee pretty bad in like my junior year, so any opportunity for scholarships were out the window. And although I had acceptances to a variety of places, I ended up having to go where the money was, right? So what I could afford, what my family could afford. Brought me to Rhode Island, right, where Big Picture was founded. I went to Johnson & Wales University. Knew I wanted to study business, right? So I figured you want to make money. I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do, but I figured I wanted to not struggle, right? I wanted to be okay. In my senior year, I ran into Donique Dolly, who was one of the early, you know Donique? Donique Dolly, who was one of the founding advisors at the Met. He was in graduate school. He was at Brown, MAT. We'd have late night conversations. Also from the Bronx. We had late night conversations.
Watching now, they get to Brooklyn.
Yeah. Late night conversations about why, he was persistent and insistent that absolutely I needed to go and be a teacher. You needed to go in the classroom. We need more brothers. We need more men that look like us. We need, like, it's a shame. You have too much. He was not in those words, right, if you can imagine. But, and we would argue. And I'm like, absolutely not. Schools stink. Your experience at Rice, which is where he attended, which is a private school in New York City, didn't mirror mine at Clinton. So I said, until you figure out what school's going to look like, I'm going to go and make some money. We lost track. I think just naturally through my growth, right, I ended up going from corporate to nonprofit. So then I went into an international nonprofit. So started figuring out kind of, and I grew up, I got married, right? So started really soul searching and figuring out what mattered to me. Left corporate, went to an international nonprofit. About, this is about, from the time I left, from the time I met Donique till that point where I was at the nonprofit was about a window of about 6 years. 2 years into the nonprofit, I run into Donique one late night in downtown Providence. We were both out partying somewhere, right? And then we went to like this restaurant, like where everyone goes to go get food. And he says, remember those conversations we used to have? I've got the school for you. I've got the school for you. I'm about to be a principal. And I said, wait a minute, that's 6 years. How are you already going to be a principal? I'm a little worried about that, actually, just starting with that. And I know your habits, bro, so I'm like, he said, no, for real. This is the thing that we've been talking about. So sure, we exchanged cards, went our merry way. He harassed me. Said, you got to come. And this is before the Met's expansion, right? So this is not the Met with a beautiful public street campus, for those of you that are familiar with it. This is at the Shepherd Building, one floor, 80 kids in a corporate building, right? Just like regular corporate building. He hounds me. I take a half a day, I go visit the school. He says, just go talk. Just go in classrooms, go in advisories. Nick Jackson.
Nick Jackson,
student, young man.
Yeah.
African-American male, pulls me aside. He says immediately, who are you, right? Why are you here? Are you thinking about being a teacher here? I'm like, I know Donique. He just told me to come by. I'm just here to learn. And he proceeds to grill me. He's like, so, what's your experience? And like, what did you do? And then he starts telling me about the amazing work he's done. Now, he's a senior on his way to North Carolina State from the south side of Providence. Talks about the work that he's done in real estate, where he's helping low-income families buy homes in Providence, first-generation folks to buy homes. Like, with such a passion, like, that was it. Nick Jackson is why I committed to the Met, and in a lot of ways, and then I met Dennis, and then I met Elliot, and their passion and drive, it wasn't superficial, wasn't about bells and whistles. And my goal is that whether black, white, ELL, special education, why, it doesn't matter. Like that access, everyone needs to be able to have access to this. Right? That's why.
We also sat down one-on-one with Carlos to discuss effective dialogue. One way to accomplish that, Carlos states, is to ensure the student is heard.
Whenever you can, include student voice as much as possible. So student voice, student choice in the classroom, hands-on activities, projects, as much as possible. Make it real, make it relevant to young people, make it current, right? So, not something that happened 50, not always about something that happened 50,000 years ago, but something that's currently happening in their local communities. And you can do that by starting by asking the students, like, what's going on in their community? What are some things that they're hearing? What are some things that are going on? I think that's really important.
This podcast and other podcasts like it is available through Libsyn, which allows you to listen to podcasts on iTunes as well as all other podcast dissemination services. To access our library of podcasts, visit www.hightechhigh.org/MOOCs and click on the podcast logo. That's www.hightechhigh.org/MOOCs and click on the podcast logo.